Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. The next time you eat a piece of avocado toast, thank a hippie. That dish, which has become a breakfast and lunch staple, was invented at a health food restaurant in L.A. back in the 60s. But back then, it was topped by a slice of Havarti cheese. Now, back in the 60s and 70s, eating tofu and brown bread were practically political acts. Yogurt was hard to find, and food co-ops were one of the few places you could buy whole grains, quinoa, or organic produce. But today, you can find any of these items in a major supermarket. Indeed, organic farming is a $40 billion industry, and the juice and smoothie industry is itself a $3 billion business in the U.S. And another fun fact, since 2007, the number of farms growing kale has nearly tripled. My guest tonight, Jonathan Kaufman, knows all about these food trends, and he argues that besides bell-bottoms and politics, one of the lasting impacts of the hippie movement is how it changed the way that we eat. Jonathan is a James Beard Award-winning journalist and author of Hippie Foods: How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. He joins us tonight from Portland, Oregon, and I'm pleased to spend the hour with him to learn more about how what is old is new again. So welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me on the show, Ethan.
And we hope you will join us for the conversation when we open the phone lines in 20 minutes. You can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And if you want to email or text us now with any questions, you can do so at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can also reach us by tweeting at cityvisionskalw. We want to know, what is the food that you're eating today that was once revolutionary? Did you grow up in the 70s, and did your parents sprinkle wheat germ on your food? How do you feel about Wonder Bread? Those are some of the questions we want to hear from you when we open those phone lines up in just about 20 minutes. So, Jonathan, what is hippie food, and why does it matter?
Well, I tend to define hippie food as the food I grew up with. I mean, I think of whole grains, whole wheat bread, lentils, sprouts, organic vegetables, a lot of food that was, you know, back in the 70s was very brown and very earthy. And now these days, I definitely think that all of those, you know, all of those foods that we ate back then, we're eating now. It's just we've shifted a little bit better. We're cooking it a little bit better.
And you argue in the book that it was really the hippies from the 60s that helped make this now a mainstream kind of a food. So why did the hippies pick up on this type of eating?
Well, I think the counterculture kids and generally the baby boomers were, you know, in the as the 1960s were kind of steamrolling on, I think the counterculture especially, which had been, you know, really energized by direct action politics in the early 60s, was becoming was feeling more and more disenfranchised. The war kept rolling on, and people kept dying in Vietnam, and you know, Nixon was elected, and you know, despite all of their efforts, and so I think people feeling the sense of disillusionment about politics decided they wanted to take on that they couldn't necessarily change the world as it was, but what they could change was themselves. And so I think that you see starting in 1970 a kind of a pulling away from many from, you know, political action and movement toward communes, the back to land movement, starting food co-ops, and definitely really rethinking the way they ate.
And it seems like, as you trace in the book, a lot of these foods go back thousands of years. Some of these foods are really traditional in nature. I mean, certainly from places like Japan and Indonesia, but, you know, even in some of the traditions in the U.S. that go back centuries. Is it fair to say that it took that sort of post-war generation to really kind of popularize and standardize them for a broader audience?
Yes and no. I mean, one of the things that really surprised me when I started my research was that, you know, a lot of these foods that I really associated with, you know, the 70s did go back 150 years. And you know, when I looked at whole wheat bread, for example, Sylvester Graham was a vegetarian proselytizer who was traveling around the Northeast in the 1830s and 40s, preaching the virtues of whole wheat bread, and it was a critique of industrial milling at the time. But it, you know, whole wheat bread and Graham flour, even what we know now as Graham crackers, kind of stuck around, you know, kind of in small health food stores and in Seventh Day Adventist circles. What the counterculture folks in the 1970s did was they they pulled all of these foods together and they recontextualized them as natural foods. They were looking for an antidote to industrial farming, industrialized food supply, additives, pesticides. And so they were kind of stripping away as much of the commercial food as they could and then looking to these older sources, these fringe sources for information about health.
And a lot of the book really details how this was a reaction against factory-made food. And mm-hmm. I would assume that that was more prevalent in the U.S. than, let's say, in Europe or Asia. Is that accurate? And, I mean, was this a particularly American type of rebellion against industrial food that was mostly found in the U.S., or did we see this in other countries?
I think we saw it in some other countries, but not to the same degree. And I think partly because America was, you know, in the post-World War II era, America was so quick to rush to industrialize the food supply. I mean, more than 500 additives were, were added to the food supply in the 1950s and 1960s. And, you know, farming underwent this complete revolution where it became dependent on chemical fertilizers, pesticides, and tractors. And supermarkets especially replaced small grocery stores, and so like we were kind of developing these mass market foods and changing how food should be sold in cans or in freezers rather than sort of, you know, something you'd buy from a local grocer or from a farmer's market. So Americans were seeing the most extreme changes in the food supply, and so their reaction, I think, was I don't know if I would call it extreme, but it was the most dramatic.
And you chronicle a number of really interesting characters who brought all this to life. I mean, some could be considered hippies, but some are just, just unusual kind of lost soul types. I mean, there's some criminals involved here. Did you find that there was any specific character trait that maybe was common throughout these different characters that you detail that made them open to this new type of food and really yearning to bring it to a more popular audience?
It's really hard to sort of separate the genius from the kook sometimes, and I think you had these folks, somebody like George Osawa, who was the founder of Macrobiotics, who was saying in 1960 that, you know, heart disease, obesity, diabetes, even cancer were all caused by the, you know, industrialized food supply, and what we really needed to do was to return to seasonal local whole grain eating. But then he would also combine that with, you know, these ideas that, you know, smoking was actually good for you, and then if you ate nothing but brown rice and maybe a little bit of miso soup for 10 days, you could completely change the structure of your body's relationship with itself and with the universe. So a lot of the early kids who followed those brown rice diets developed scurvy. But what I did see was this, they really did combine, a lot of folks did combine an alternative worldview, an alternative life, along with these sort of ideas, other ideas about food. And so I think anybody, the counterculture kids who were exploring the fringes in many ways in terms of religion, in terms of drugs, in terms of their relationship to sexuality, were also, they were looking at anybody who was on the fringe because they felt like they could learn lessons from them that had been overlooked or poo-pooed by, you know, traditional science.
Well, and you mentioned that some of these disciples ended up coming down with scurvy, and I noted that a few of these people, you know, selling the health benefits died of heart attacks pretty young. But so, you know, obviously the evidence didn't really fit with some of the claims in some of these early cases. But were there any particular characters that you documented in the book that you felt like really were, you know, really onto something well before their time, that just seemed like they were kind of more accurate in their claims than some of the other folks who, you know, whose beliefs were later exposed to just not be true once science and experience sort of took hold?
Well, I mean, I did fall in love a little bit with Adele Davis, who was actually kind of the best known of the alternate nutritionists. She actually had a degree she'd studied nutrition at the USC, and she came out with a number of books called Let's Eat Right and Let's Raise Our Kids, Let's Eat Right and Let's Get Fit. Forgetting exactly the words, but she was a big proponent of vitamins and looking at all the nutrition around, you know, vitamins and how they were depleted from the industrialized food supply. And she could go to some extremes. Like, she advocated, you know, just huge amounts of supplements, but she was saying things about like whole wheat, about industrial milling of flour and the battle in 1940 to whether we should enrich flour or whether we should find ways to, you know, just sell people get people whole wheat flour instead. And she was saying, you know, using enriched flour is like having a burglar come into your house and steal all of your jewels and then return a few of them to you. So but the person I really fell in love with, who was kind of my, I wouldn't call him my spiritual guru, but he was definitely, it's definitely somebody who didn't really have a dark side, as far as I could tell, was Gypsy Boots. And Gypsy Boots had been born in San Francisco and ended up sort of living in the wilderness for 20 years. He joined this band of folks named the who called themselves the Nature Boys, and they traveled up and down California picking fruit and living in canyons and wearing their hair long, often, you know, going nude. And then they all kind of washed up in L.A. in the 50s, where they, you know, would like so go on to Muscle Beach and sort of parade around singing, you know, singing and dancing. And one of them, Eden Abes, composed a song called Nature Boy that was adopted by Nat King Cole and became a major hit. But Gypsy, just, you know, free spirit that he was booked onto the Steve Allen show as like sort of a kook talent. And he, you know, he sort of swung on stage and fixed Steve Allen smoothies, and he became a regular guest. And he was so ebullient, so, and his enthusiasm for juices and smoothies was so infectious that he ended up having a fan base and teaching a lot of people about, you know, eating fresh fruit.
Yeah, and I meant to actually go on YouTube and see if there are any clips of him, because I'm sure that would be pretty entertaining to see him from back in the day on the Steve Allen show. And, you know, on the subject of Hollywood and Steve Allen and Nat King Cole, as you just mentioned, you know, it's easy here in the Bay Area to think that we're the center of this whole, you know, kind of hippie movement, but certainly the hippie food movement too. But it was interesting to read in the book how so much of this does center in Southern California and the confluence of the burgeoning entertainment industry and that mass media machine down there, and how the hippie food movement was able to really plug into that through the Steve Allen show, as you mentioned. Can you talk a little bit more about the role of Southern California in all this?
Yeah, L.A. became a haven for health seekers back in the end of the 19th century when the railroad lines connected the East Coast to Southern California. And so in those early few years, there was this boom in sanatoriums for tuberculosis sufferers. And then sort of spiritual seekers started arriving. And then when Hollywood started up, you know, there was this confluence of folks who were really interested in health, really interested in alternative spiritual practices, and then people really interested in beauty and looking good. And so from the 1910s, 1920s on, LA was, and Southern California was a real destination for folks who were like with raw foodists, with folks, you know, adopting sort of these other diets, for yoga practitioners, who were, you know, becoming vegetarian because of their Vedantic studies. And because LA was also the center of the broadcast industry, you know, starting in the 1920s, 1930s, you know, there would be celebrity magazines that would talk about how, you know, some of these celebrities and the strange foods that they were eating, or somebody like Jack LaLanne, who, you know, was born in Oakland but moved down to Southern California, became this daytime TV fitness guru. And also the health food movement, all these little tiny health food stores that would pop up all over the United States. Many of them had their bases, their organizations or companies that supplied them were all based in Southern California.
Well, and I suppose it makes sense that these actors and actresses would be really keyed into, obviously as they are now, into health and looking good, and they probably would be open to a lot of these recommendations around food. And, mm-hmm. and one of the tenets that you describe of this movement initially was that a truly healthy body would not get sick, fasting, exercise, toxins, and impurities from the blood, and flour and sugar were poison. So that, you know, it sounds like stuff that it's pretty mainstream. You might read in a health magazine today, but can you describe why it was considered so radical back then?
I think it was radical for a couple reasons. One was that, you know, the science around nutrition was really in its infancy, and vitamins really weren't, you know, weren't discovered until the end of the 20th century, end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And so people didn't really understand what it took to be healthy. They had some understanding that, you know, you needed protein, fat, carbohydrates, but some of these other nutrients, you know, and then the fact that you needed to get them from fresh and cooked vegetables or whole grains just really wasn't well known. But I think the other reason is because they would do things like, you know, eat nothing but raw food or eat lots of salads. And those were just out of the American, typical American diet.
It's a very much counterculture at that point. And I thought one of the interesting passages in your book was when you're describing how the book Diet for a Small Planet came about. Frances LaPay, who actually researched it just across the bay over at UC Berkeley, as she was putting that book together. And she really touched on the environmental needs around mm-hmm. food and tapping into those concerns. How did Frances LaPay end up shifting people's thinking about food through her book?
Well, Frances LaPay, she also became, I think, one of my other big heroes from researching the book. She was a young grad student in Berkeley who had kind of dropped out of the social sciences program but was really occupied with the problem of world hunger. And what is it that's causing poverty and hunger? And so she spent all of this time in the UC Berkeley Agricultural Economics Library looking at crop reports and nutritional profiles. And she came to this conclusion that the global hunger was not endemic, as people were suggesting at the time, that actually the real problem was that we were feeding all of these grains and legumes that we were growing, especially in America, to animals to produce meat instead of directly to humans. And she felt like she kind of came to the conclusion that if United States alone could satisfy 90% of the world's protein requirements with what we were growing. And so what was so impactful about her book, Diet for a Small Planet, was twofold. One was that she was offering a practical way forward. She was sort of saying that the food that you eat has these larger consequences that you can affect through your diet the global hunger. And the other thing that she really was part of this big shift was looking at food as a political act. Really, when I was looking at these food and nutrition books from the early 20th century through 1970, people would talk about dietary choices in terms of health, sometimes in terms of spirituality, definitely in terms of wealth and what you could afford and practicality. But nobody was talking about eating as a political act. But that really caught it inspired a lot of people who were looking to infuse the world around them with their political choices, and it really sparked a massive vegetarian movement.
Well, and it also coincided with the rise of the environmental movement in the U.S. And yeah. I think those two really played off each other in terms of what she was saying on the diet side, which is still really relevant today. We think about climate change and the need to shift our diet away from meat, just in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. But I was struck by some of these claims and the fear at the time that the world's going to run out of food, and obviously. Since then, we've seen tremendous advancements in agricultural science and agricultural productivity. I mean, has science essentially proven somebody like Frances LaPay wrong to some extent, this concern around it being a small planet? I mean, we know it is in some ways, but given how the technology has improved so much, is it still as relevant today?
Oh, I think it's even more relevant. I think what happened was her book came out and all these concerns, like books like Famine 1975 came out right about in the early 70s, and it was right before the Green Revolution had hit Asia and Africa. And so the Green Revolution, which introduced these varietals of wheats and grains that were sort of super producers, but they did require a lot more in terms of fertilizer and mechanical farming techniques, staved off the fears that, you know, especially in Asia, sort of this idea that the famine was becoming endemic. However, now that we're, you know, closing in on 8 billion people and we're running out of arable land, where there are concerns about water and energy use to produce the food that we've grown accustomed to, people are now kind of coming back to this argument, some of them without even knowing about, you know, Diet for a Small Planet, what Frankie was arguing, you know, 50 years ago.
Yeah, so it's time to eat that soy burger still, just as much as back in the 70s, sounds like.
Definitely.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco, and streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Our guest tonight is Jonathan Kaufman, author of Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Change the Way We Eat. He's also a former San Francisco Chronicle food columnist. Well, we invite you to call in with any questions or comments. We want to know, what hippie foods are you eating? What is a food trend that you think will stand the test of time? The number to call to join this conversation is 1-866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. We'll be monitoring those. You can also reach us on Twitter by using at cityvisionskalw. Well, Jonathan, it seemed like a lot of the motivation that not just these hippies, but the public at large that was receptive to their message around food, it seems like a lot of it really boiled down to fear. They were fear of annihilation from nuclear bombs, fear of running out of food, as we were just discussing, fear of all the health impacts from industrialized processed foods. Can you describe a little bit about, you know, whether or not you think that's true, and a little bit more about some of those fears and why they were so prevalent and maybe still are today?
I do think that's true, and I think that when you add on to that the fear that the society is falling apart, that I think, you know, drove the Back to the Land movement, or the idea that we had to create our own communities outside the shell of this decaying society. That was another sort of factor. But for example, the fear of pesticides, I mean, and the effects of pesticides. You know, 1964 represented the publication of Silent Spring, Rachel Carson's book about the dangers of DDT, which was the most widely used pesticide at the time, and showed people that, you know, what the government was telling them was safe and what scientists were telling them was safe turns out to have these huge impacts on the environment and on possibly on human health. So, you know, you can see the effect of this fear on people's dietary choices, you know, continues with the spread of the organic movement. If you talk to farmers and if you talk to organic advocates or environmentalists, you know, they talk about why their reasons for growing organically is because of this, you know, it's a sort of holistic love of the land, this real respect for the soil and fear of the depletion of topsoils, this really valuable topsoil that actually produces all of our food, and the concern that we just can't farm through science for very long, you know, for much longer. But when you talk to Americans, sort of general populace, about why they buy organic produce at the store, a lot of it comes down to, well, I just want food that is raised without chemicals.
Yeah, it's a lot of that fear of being poisoned, basically, by your food. Mm-hmm. I was struck by that one story of those, I guess, back to landers, you could call them, who moved out to Chico thinking that would basically be able to escape any nuclear bomb blast and fallout by growing food out there. So it's really kind of a time capsule from a different era, although I suppose one that always can come back, given that these weapons certainly aren't going away anytime soon. I want to talk about some of the specific foods that you mentioned. I found this really fascinating because it is true how ubiquitous some of these foods are. So puffed rice cakes, for example. I mean, I just, you know, I'm Gen X, and I just kind of take it for granted that this is a staple snack. But can you describe a bit about how the puffed rice cake came about? This is a hippie food that I think everyone would agree is now mainstream.
Yeah, that was a big surprise for me, actually. It was kind of, I discovered the history of the rice cake right as I was starting my research, and I thought, oh my gosh, this story is going to be a lot wilder, take a lot more turns than I suspected. So in 1961, a group of early macrobiotic followers of George Osawa moved to Chico Chico, California, as you mentioned, because they had studied sort of they'd studied nuclear fallout estimates and looked at, you know, geography and decided that Chico, California was far enough from major nuclear targets that they would sort of escape fallout, but it was also close to their sort of principal grain, which is brown rice. And so they you know, sort of a truckload of a convoy travels across the country from New York, settles in Chico, tries to figure out what how they're going to live macrobiotically in this new strange small town, and a couple of them start up this little business importing all of these macrobiotic staples like soy sauce, miso, you know, green tea, and they. But they're just not having much success selling their products. I mean, the early macrobiotics believed that yeast was the yeasted breads were bad for you because yeast ate sugar and you shouldn't eat sugar. So they would bake these bricks of dough that they would, you know, you'd have to shave off into fine shavings of whole wheat bread, and then they would try and sell them to health food stores, and nobody was buying. And so George Osawa, the founder, came to visit and suggested, well, you know, why don't you make these little senbei, these puff rice cakes, and, you know, he went back to Japan, and he sent them a machine that made like two at a time, and so they started making these little tiny puff rice cakes, and they took off. And so this company called Chico-san became the first and largest producer of rice cakes, puffed rice cakes in the United States. And so they were looking for, because they believed that they should be farming without chemicals, you know, pesticides, they were looking for somebody to convert to grow brown rice organically, and they just didn't have much success. Their early supplier was Kota Farms, which is one of the first Japanese American farms in the state. It still grows wonderful rice, but they finally had luck approaching these four brothers who lived in Richvale, not that far away, and worked at this guarantee where they would pay them a certain amount more for their crop in order for them to start, you know, to start growing all naturally and then selling just to them. And those four brothers were the Lundberg family farms. And so they made the switch in 1970 or 1971, and it made the company. They're the largest supplier of organic brown rice to natural food stores around the country.
Yeah, you certainly see Lundberg brands in the supermarket aisles today. So that's a local Northern California story, really driven by, as you described, by the demand for rice cakes, which is pretty fascinating. And you mentioned brown rice as this kind of staple of the hippie diet, and certainly for these folks coming out to Chico. Why brown rice?
Partly because of macrobiotics, and partly because, you know, the counterculture kids stumbled on George Osawa's writings, you know, in like the late 1960s, and it was the first fully articulated natural foods diet when they had no idea what they should be cooking. They just knew it should be whole foods. So here was this guy who was telling them they should eat lots of brown rice and stir-fried vegetables and you know, strange things like, you know, seitan, which was wheat gluten. But partly because I think it was, you know, it was the brown rice and stir-fry became, to me, that's one of the quintessential hippie food dishes, and it's still a dish that I cook for myself. And I think it, you know, just had this air of wholesomeness. You could buy all the ingredients cheaply. It was vegetarian, and you could cook it for large groups. So it was, you know, what more could you ask from a dish?
And is brown rice better for you than regular white rice or other types of rice?
Largely because the bran of the rice contains most of the nutrients. It also contains a lot of the oils, which makes it both, you know, it goes rancid more easily and sort of tastes bad. And also, organic brown rice is more attractive to pests, and so it has to be stored differently, as well as, you know, as well as milled differently.
And I guess it's attractive to pests because there's actually some nutrients there to eat. Is that right?
Right.
So that's kind of ironic. So this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're also streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Our guest tonight is Jonathan Kaufman, author of Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Longhairs, and Revolutionaries Change the Way We Eat. We've got him for the full hour talking about hippie foods and talking about how they became mainstream. now they're just food, basically. So we want to hear from you. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. We want to hear, were you part of the Wonder Bread debates about how white bread isn't good for you? It's better to go to whole wheat. We want to hear about your culinary history and attitudes. The number to call to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. Well, let's go to the phone lines. We have David from Oakland. David, thank you for calling into City Visions.
Well, thanks for taking my call. This whole thing is a large piece of my history, and I guess I should start by saying, brought up by a European-raised father who thought that white bread was trash. Mind you, he ate pastries, too, but he was very clear that whole wheat bread had real stuff and white bread you could not live on. But I was part of the food conspiracy, and before that, when I lived in New York, I used to eat at a place called The Paradox, which was a macrobiotic restaurant. It's where I learned to use chopsticks. It's where I learned to love miso and tempura. And they used to bake a bread that was 80% cooked brown rice that was just divine. And it didn't need yeast. It was just tasty and chewy and wonderful. And
Those are great recollections, and I think really speak to the value of this food, is that it's not only healthy for you and interesting, but it tastes really good.
Well, my entire attitude toward what I will or will not eat is whether I like how it tastes. The only thing that the senior Mr. Bush and I have in common is I don't like broccoli. Yawn. So what?
So
I eat lamb's tongues. But the point being that, you make your choices based on what you like the taste of, and I'm about to hit 75. I haven't died yet of any of this stuff. So, and I was part of the food conspiracy here in the Bay Area. We used to drive to Strauss Dairy and pick up, raw organic milk and stuff like that, and distribute it around to the neighborhood conspiracies in the early 70s, and that was really cool.
Well, David, more power to you. We appreciate you sharing some of your experiences. Jonathan, you must hear from folks like David now that this book is out and you've really delved into this history. What are some of your thoughts and response?
I do, and it's been delightful, to talk to. I feel like in many parts I was writing to two different generations, three actually, but the first was the people who lived this experience, who had kind of forgotten a lot of these memories, or it was a way to put them in new context. And the other was the generation like me. I was born in the early 70s, Generation X, and I grew up eating this food, and it was sort of a torture to me as a child in many ways. I did not like whole wheat bread. I did not like carob. I didn't like brown rice. But the lessons from that movement definitely stuck with me. And so I find fellow folks who went through this sort of the school lunch trauma around what you bring, and other kids make fun of you, or you were eating differently than most of your peers, but then you come to really appreciate what you grew up with.
Well, I want to thank David for those recollections and that perspective. I also want to hear from Nikki in San Francisco calling in. Nikki, welcome to City Visions.
Oh, hi. Hi. I just want to say that the eating of natural foods is, in my case, was a big backlash to all the processed junk food. The Twinkies and the Chef Boyardee, and there was a lot of canned food, back in the 60s and 70s, and I was a teenager in the 70s, and I loved the New York Times Natural Foods Cookbook, and I just always made desserts that were very whole grain and not with white sugar, and so there was a lot of backlash against nutrient poor kinds of processed foods. And I ate a lot of fruits and vegetables all along, and I was really glad because, when I was in my 30s, I got sort of a delayed case of what people used to call juvenile diabetes. And with diabetes, either type 1 or type 2, the best thing you can do is you know, steer away from, you know, the processed food and the, you know, the more fruits and vegetables and whole grains, because it kind of, you know, is better for your blood sugar levels.
Yeah, absolutely, you know. Nikki. Well, I think you're raising, you know, a pretty common concern out there around the impact of these processed foods. And, you know, Jonathan, one question I have for you on this subject is, with the rise of hippie food, some of these hippie foods now mainstream, has it come at the expense of some of the junk food? I mean, how are we doing in terms of eating junk food versus more healthy hippie food?
Well, I don't know that the movement actually, you know, shifted the American demand for junk food, and unfortunately, it didn't halt the obesity epidemic. And but what it did, people are eating more meat than they were eating. But it did offer viable alternatives for people who do choose to eat well and who have the resources to eat well, and also, you know, who have the interest. And so it provided, you know, created this a completely different supply network and a completely different, you know, the sort of a network of organic farmers who are actively and activists who are working to change the way agriculture works. I also think that, you know, you were talking about how you were raised on canned food, the caller was, and I think I feel like a generation kind of lost, over the course of a generation, they lost the knowledge of how to cook from scratch. And so what I encountered from counterculture kids was, you know, they were teaching themselves to cook. Many of them were teaching themselves to cook in a way that their parents didn't even, you know, necessarily know how to do. But they were trying to do it with all of these new ingredients.
A real sort of cultural change there. I mean, you saw that generation to generation then.
Yeah, and also, I mean, this was the generation that really embraced the flavors and a lot of the ingredients from you know, Asia, Latin America, Africa. It was the first generation to sort of to see American cooking as a real culinary hodgepodge.
Well, and you mentioned Asia, and I was also struck in the book about how much of this food is coming from Asia. I mean, certainly a lot of it's coming from Japan in terms of tofu, and also tempeh from Indonesia. Can you describe a little bit about how those connections came about?
I think a lot of the one of the drivers for the counterculture generation was interest in spiritual traditions outside Christianity, and I think there was a huge interest both in Indian-based spiritual practices and in Zen Buddhism and Taoism, and so there was a great curiosity about Asian cultures among white middle-class kids who made up the bulk of the counterculture. And then for you know, us living on the coast, especially California, there was you know, there were these long-established Chinese-American, Japanese-American communities, Filipino-American communities, who were, you know, so a lot of the foods were easier to come by for the broader populace, and it was, you had more contact with things like tofu and sprouts and soybean sprouts and things like stir-fry.
So interesting, interesting connection. I think it probably helped that the West Coast was maybe a little bit closer and had some of that influence from immigration as well over here. I mean, certainly the Zen Buddhist influence here in Northern California played a part in that, as you document in the book. I want to go back to the phone lines. We have Deborah from San Francisco. Deborah, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. Only from San Francisco for the last 10 years, but previously an East Coast former macrobiotic. And, you know, I kind of have to say I was introduced to Whole Foods and the hippie food movement through an aunt when I was probably 13, who was helping people who had been given cancer diagnosis and were told were terminal. And she was one of these folks that not only had people doing vitamins and whatnot through a man who was pursued by the American Medical Association named Kerry Reams, and it was called the Reams Program, where he had them doing everything from high colonics to Whole Foods to, in some places, Laetril. My aunt would fly to Canada to get Laetril, which is based on the apricot seed extracts. And so from there, I sort of transitioned into Whole Foods and was reading the Whole Foods catalog. And from there, after watching a friend die early of cancer, I ended up getting into macrobiotics. And I have to say that, you know, I took it to a bit of an extreme, but, you know, to be frank, when you are an East Coast macrobiotic, you have a George Osawa, of course, brought it here, but one of his major students is Misho Kushi, and I actually got involved in macrobiotics to the level that I was a scribe for Misho Kushi when he was doing diagnosis, and so I actually, you know, was in the room while he was, you know, doing the oriental diagnostic techniques on people and prescribing diets, because of course macrobiotics is based on quote unquote yin yang, which is acids and alkalinities. So ultimately it was diets were individually tailored based on Chinese diagnostic techniques, which were utilized in prescribing diets to correct the imbalances of yin or yang in a person's system, thereby bringing them into a state of kind of a macrobiotic homeostasis.
Deborah, this is a really helpful overview, I think, of macrobiotics and a pretty interesting bit of that history. Jonathan, do you have thoughts in response to what Deborah's mentioning here in terms of macrobiotic philosophy here?
Yeah, I definitely did a lot of time. I spent a lot of time talking to folks in the Boston macrobiotic community. Micho and Avelin Kushi were George Osawa disciples from Japan who moved over to the United States before George ever made it here, and they ended up in Boston at the end of the 1960s, and they were pretty charismatic folks, and they created this macrobiotic community that had all these study houses around Brookline and then in Boston itself, and they would teach classes, and they had a few restaurants, and a publication called the East-West Journal that was pretty influential and reached folks well beyond macrobiotic circles.
But they also had macrobiotic counselors, and those macrobiotic counselors would travel basically from the Kushi Institute, from the Mississippi River up to Canada and all the way down to Key West, where I was located. And they literally would do these sessions, and they would be like $350, and you would have a diagnostic session with a scribe and the counselor, and they would give you a prescription of diet, and you would get adjusted in the beginning every month and then every 3 months, because they would be looking for the changes in the moisture in your skin, the temperature of your skin, your eyes, your skin color, et cetera, using diagnostic techniques. And so the diets were never stable. They were adjusted based on the adherence of the person who was having that diet prescribed to them. So what I discovered in the process, and, you know, I invited the macrobiotic counselor from Boston to come down and do a group of people in Key West, but it became extremely isolating because none of us could eat each other's diets. They were prescribed specifically for our own individual conditions. And so it got to the point where I have to say this, I honestly believe I became kind of macro neurotic. I would do things like go to a macrobiotic restaurant and fret whether or not the chef was in the right mindset, and if they were using either glass or stainless steel in the kitchen, and if they were using purified water to cook things.
So I have to cut you off because I think you know you're raising a really interesting point. I want to give Jonathan a chance to respond to this around macrobiotics.
Yeah, one of the things I did appreciate about the long-term effects of the macrobiotic and talking to folks who are in the movement was this idea that if you're listening to your body can tell you, if you're listening to the subtle responses you get from the food you eat, you will get some indications of what is healthier for you. You won't have energy swings and crashes. You won't feel sort of dull and heavy and overloaded. But there was such a tendency toward extremism. Not necessarily extremism, but exactly what you talk about. People were so obsessed with the details, and the diet could be so restrictive, and it could also be, you know, it wasn't just alienating from other macrobiotics, but from the world around you. That, it feels so restrictive that it feels joyless.
It's definitely an interesting strain of this whole hippie foods movement, and you see a little bit of that kind of neuroticism, I think, creep in as you get some colorful characters attracted to these movements. So this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Our guest tonight is Jonathan Kaufman, author of Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. We invite you to call call in with more questions and comments. A number to join this conversation is 1-866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Greg, welcome to City Visions.
Couple of things. One, I went through. Whoops, I got to turn my radio down. Sorry.
All right. How are you able to ask your question? I think we do hear a little bit of feedback there, Greg. So whenever
no,
you're ready.
I had to turn my radio down. I'm sorry, it was on too loud. The concern I had is this. I went through all of this too. I mean, I'm 75 now, and I remember the 60s. I was eating, you know, brown rice, tons of tofu, rice cakes, garbanzo beans, and stuff like that. And my diet has really gone through incredible fluctuations. I was almost a total vegetarian in the 60s, but now all over the map in terms of what I eat, although I try to eat as clean a diet as I possibly can. I was curious what your guest thinks about this. There are just so many different people advocating so many different diets now that every time I go to the library and I pick up a book, people are all over the map, and all of these people cite study after study. They all are credible. They're MDs, a lot of them, et cetera, et cetera. I'll tell you, you need to have an MD and a PhD to try and figure out, to get through the maze, to try and figure out, okay, this is what I really need to do. This is the diet I want to be on. This is the foods I can eat and I can't eat. So I don't know if your guest has anything to say about that, but I think this is much more complicated than I ever thought it was going to be.
Greg, I appreciate those comments. And for those who have read Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma, I think he talks about how we don't really have a culture of food in this country. And so there is this sort of grasping at different fads that come up. But Jonathan, any advice for Greg and people like him who are trying to figure out where do we go? How do we figure this out? This is getting complicated.
Yeah, well, I mean, I the other part of what Michael Pollan says that really resonates with me is that we haven't just lost our culinary traditions because we are a melting pot country. We believe in science. And so because we're desperate, I mean, it seems to be a shared characteristic of Americans that we all want to eat more healthfully, and we don't know what that should be. So it leads us open to suggestion to anybody who comes with some sort of scientific basis and to marketing. Because we're all, you know, anybody who wants to market something as healthier to help more helpful for us, we tend to be open to that, open to suggestion. The more I read these studies and the more diets like keto and paleo and gluten-free, the, you know, folks who aren't celiac, who don't have celiac disease, who are choosing to not eat gluten because they don't necessarily know why, or it has some certain, I don't know. What, the more I'm convinced that, you know, the hippies had it right, that eating a diet that is high in whole grains, high in vegetables, flavorful and largely meatless is really the way that we should be eating. And so, I mean, I think we sweat all of the little details and we don't look at the big picture, which is that we could have a varied diet as long as we have sort of an orientation that brings us back to those core everyday foods.
Greg, I hope that answers your question. Thank you for calling in. And, you know, on this topic, Jonathan, I was struck by that you focused on the Seventh-day Adventists. And I remember reading a book on communities around the world where people live in inordinately long lifespans. And they focused on the Loma Linda community of Seventh-day Adventists. And there are multiple factors potentially for why they tend to live long lives. Could have been that they're sort of religious social networks. But they do have this vegetarian diet. And they seem to me like a pretty good example of what you just said, that if we kind of keep it simple and, you know, eat whole grain type foods and not a lot of meat or any meat, that there is some evidence that will produce a longer, healthier lifespan.
Yeah, the Seventh-day Adventists were kind of the torchbearers for vegetarianism in America for about 100 years. And, you know, not only did they develop some of the first meat substitutes, mainly based on like wheat gluten and nut meats, like Protos and Nutos, you know, they came out with all of these products these sort of canned substitutes that are still around, like cutlets and, you know, sort of the veggie bacon. But they also, you know, proved that if you eat a healthy diet, it has these long-lasting effects.
Yeah, and the book, for those interested, Blue Zones is the name of that book that that describes Seventh-day Adventists and their long lifespans. I want to go back to the phone lines. We have Jeannie from San Francisco. Jeannie, welcome to City Visions. What's your question for Jonathan Kaufman?
Yes, I'll keep it really short. I lived in Berkeley in the 1970s, and I would like him to talk about the role of the Berkeley Follow-Up stores, all the bins of grains, organic vegetables, the recipes that they had available on all the shelves. It played a huge role in the whole food movement. So could he talk about that?
Yeah, no, great question, Jeannie. Sure. You're breaking up a little bit, but I'll just restate it for anyone who had trouble hearing. You asked about Berkeley Bowl and all the bins of Whole Foods in those Berkeley Bowl aisles, and how that really played into this whole movement. Jonathan, your thoughts?
Sure. Yeah, it wasn't the Berkeley Bowl per se, but there was the Berkeley Food Co-op, was a network of stores that really dated back to the 1930s. There was actually a food co-op movement. There have been a few over the course of American history, but there was a food co-op movement that arose out of the Depression, and ended up a lot of they had these large networks, and they produced a lot of their own foods with the Twin Pines logo that people who are maybe a little older recognize. And so by the 1960s, the Berkeley Food Co-op had a number of locations. It was really set up in large part like a grocery store. Not so much a member-owned co-op in the way that the later co-ops founded. But then out of the 1970s came the Berkeley Food Conspiracy, which another caller mentioned. This idea, these buying clubs that the communes and other households would gather together, and they would go buy foods in bulk from suppliers like Strauss, but also the local farmers markets, and then they would split them up. And a lot of those food conspiracies ended up being member co-ops. And so this idea of eating healthy food became entwined with this idea of creating a post-capitalist economy based on human connection. And so food co-ops sprung up all over the country. There was an estimated 5,000 that sprung up around the country in the early 1970s. And they were all brought to build community, to create these other economies, and also to bring, you know, natural foods that were very hard to find in grocery stores to, you know, large cities and tiny towns alike.
Well, and one of those co-ops eventually morphed into Whole Foods and now owned by Amazon. So interesting kind of through line there. So we have Reed from San Francisco calling in. Reed, welcome to City Visions. Reed, I'm hearing some feedback. Are you there?
Yes.
All right. Might we need to turn your radio down? But
it's off.
Okay, great. We'd love to hear your question for Jonathan Kaufman.
Hello?
Yeah. Go ahead. That's your question.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. I hadn't heard the term Mediterranean diet at all. And I was born in Northern California in 1940. And to me, I was always raised with the idea that California was basically had a Mediterranean climate, and the basis of the diet was, if not French, then Italian, certainly Italian. But I have yet to hear in this conversation Mediterranean diet, and basically that's the way I've eaten all of my life.
Well, Reed, you just said it right now. Let's hear what Jonathan has to say. Where does the term Mediterranean diet play into this hippie food movement?
Sure. The idea of the Mediterranean diet being sort of the healthiest diet, you know, it really comes out of the 80s and 90s. We're talking about it as the Mediterranean diet per se, and really specifically looking at Italy and Greece and some of the areas around the Mediterranean. I think in California, we have always eaten people who've grown up in California have always eaten more vegetables, more fruits, because the supply of fresh fruits and vegetables was year-round, and it was so good and it was so cheap. When I talk to folks who lived in Vermont in 1968 or in South Carolina, it was really hard to find things like avocados and artichokes that we associate with the Mediterranean diet, with California in general. So it took a few decades for that supply chain to reach the East Coast. And also in California, the olive oil industry and the wine industry really took off in the 1970s and 80s. And I think that also helped make California such a natural place to think about, the Mediterranean diet as being very close to our diet.
And we're very fortunate, as you mentioned, here in California. We have over 400 commodity crops growing just right here in the state. And so we can take advantage of that with a Mediterranean diet. So thank you, Reed, for that question. Jonathan, I have to ask you, with our few minutes that we have left, what are some of your favorite hippie foods? You talk a lot about them in the book. We talked a little bit about tofu. We haven't gone there, but pretty much covered a bunch of them. What do you like to eat?
Well, I will say that tofu was my favorite food growing up. I mean, that was like tofu and lentils were my two favorite foods, and they still continue to be. And it's funny to watch my nephew and niece, who are now 10 and 14, who have grown up eating tofu as well and love it just as much as their mother and I have. I think it's a great kids' food. I have to say that through researching the book and cooking from the cookbooks, I have refound found a new love for whole wheat bread and for brown rice. I think, my reset food, the two foods that kind of I cook when I feel like I've been eating too much rich stuff are lentil soup with kale and hippie stir fry, which is brown rice, tofu, stir fried vegetables, and then just sort of look garlic, ginger, and soy.
All right, perfect fare for our dinner hour conversation here. And I have to ask then, for those listening and would like to buy some of these foods and may not know where the best place to go, where would you recommend here in the Bay Area these food outlets for people to find hippie food?
Well, if you're in San Francisco, I got to give a shout out to Rainbow Food Co-op and to Outer Avenues. Outer Avenues. Sorry, in the Sunset. There's two of the food co-ops from the 1970s who've stuck around and they were still worker owned, and they've got Rainbow in particular has an amazing selection of both produce and things like cheese.
Well, we miss you certainly as you're a reporter for the Chronicle here in San Francisco and just moved to Portland. But, now that you've got a broader perspective on this issue, what do you see as the trends going forward? What's the sort of next hippie food that we should be on the lookout for?
I still think we've yet to see the extent to which the vegan diet and plant-based meats will influence the way we cook and eat. I'm not a vegan by any stretch of the imagination, but I think there's a spread of interest in plant-based eating and this idea that we can be flexitarian, that there's this openness to meat alternatives and to vegetarian food that I find really welcome. I have yet to see what might arise out of keto and paleo, but I have to say, having looked at some of the extremes of the health food movement of the 50s and 60s and the counterculture movement, things like Sprouts and Carob that we've kind of dropped away, that there is an innate I believe in the innate good sense of our interest in healthful food, and so some of the extremes of those diets may drop away, and some of the notions that are maybe a little more healthful will stick around.
All right. Well, on that optimistic note, we're going to have to leave it there. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guest tonight was Jonathan Kaufman, author of the book Hippie Food. Thanks, Jonathan, so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me.
And for a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, please visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer tonight was David LaTulipe, and tonight's show was produced by Grace Wan and Susie Britton. Join us next week at 7 o'clock Monday night for another live City Visions. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week.